Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome back to another episode of the Breaking the Plane podcast. I am Joe Scherr, your host. I am joined currently by our co-host Burge, our third chair Hogan, and I'm going to say it, I don't care, but everybody else can kick rocks. Our favorite guest, Manish Mehta. Thank you so much for coming on again today, man. I'll throw it to you first, man. How you been since the last time? We've been a couple months. How you been since the last time we talked to you?
I'm doing great. The weather's turning. I don't know what it's like up there, but where I'm at, it was like 75 or low 70s today, so no complaints.
Yeah, suck that, New Hampshire boys. Have fun with that fucking snow. Burge, what's up, buddy? How you doing?
I also enjoyed a nice 70-degree day today. Got the grill out for the first time. So sign that good weather is coming, and I cannot wait. We just had a snowstorm up here last week. And I was stuck at work for a couple of days, and I'm like, it's April, the beginning of April. What the hell? But alas, it's all gone. So spring is here.
Hogan, you still digging out? How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing all right. Had a little bit of a head cold there for a minute. The good old wife, you know, decided to get sick and then transfer that to me. I love her to death. Thank you so much to my beautiful, amazing wife for getting me sick. That was awesome.
A little anyway, CYA right here. We call it the cover your ass BTP segment.
You know how it is. You know how it is. But no, I'm feeling 10 times better. I'm ready to rock and roll. And Manish, I'm so happy to have you back, man. It was a pleasure having you here the first time. I'm ready to rock and roll. Joe, what do we got?
Babe, if you're listening, please still listen. I'm just kidding. All right, we'll jump right into the football here. So we had you on in January at some point in time. Maybe it was February. It's been like 6 weeks, 2 months, and kind of the dead spot of the football calendar has been a little bit hot. I think when we talked last time, we talked about a certain team that we were behind the whole season. You were starting to beat the drum behind, based on the kind of beginning part of the free agency here. It's the Houston Texans, man. I guess I'll start with the Mixon trade. I want to get into the more recent acquisition here, but I kind of want to start there. They go out, they get Mixon in free agency via trade. They sign Danielle Hunter via free agency. And then they're kind of using that rookie QB contract to kind of load up here. What do you see from the Texans? Are you impressed by what they're doing? And are you optimistic? I mean, kind of a rhetorical question here, but are you kind of optimistic for their future going forward here?
I am. And, you know, Joe, you and I talked last week. We joked about it before we went on here today. We're set the over-under at, 18 and a half, 19 wins. you know, they certainly made a lot of splashy moves, but,
I'm still going over, though. I'm still going over.
And going over? Well, look, Nick Caserio is really – using the blueprint that smart general managers and smart organizations do, which is to kind of load up around your young rookie quarterback while he's on his rookie contract. You saw most recently Seattle, a decade or so ago, they did that around Russell Wilson, where they ended up getting really quality draft picks and then signing those non-quarterbacks to the larger deals while Russell Wilson was on his rookie contract. So, clearly, the Texans see a path to the Super Bowl in 2024. I mean, I do too, for a number of different reasons. But the fact that you saw so much out of C.J. Stroud last year, and now you're not only beefing up, some of the offensive weapons that he's going to have at his disposal with Joe Mixon, and then obviously most recently adding Stephon Diggs, but even upgrading, frankly, on the defense. And some of these guys are older. Hunter's older. Autry, who had a double-digit sacks last year in Tennessee, he's an older player as well. But clearly they see a runway to win the Lombardi Trophy, which is funny because when you typically think of dysfunctional organizations in the NFL over the last decade, the Texans really, they jump to the top of the line for all the dysfunction that they incurred over the last several years. But they really, hit big last year with Will Anderson and CJ Stroud, and they're being aggressive. They're going for it. And I really appreciate that mindset. It's a win now mentality, but it's not a team that's going to fall apart after 2024 if they don't win it all, just because they've set themselves up so well with a blend of quality veteran players that they've most recently added, coupled with that young core, including the quarterback. So I think what Nick Caserio has done in the last year and a half has been absolutely you know, impressive to the degree where I think that you can make a legitimate case that they'll be one of the top, you know, 3 to 5 teams when it comes to, you know, being a legit Super Bowl contender this upcoming year.
I kind of want to hold our water on the Diggs thing because we've got, especially the number one OG Bills hater down there, Burge. We got him on the podcast, so we want to get him. We want to give him a little runway. But a couple things I wanted to hit you up about is you kind of went into the ins and outs of how maybe a trade comes about in the NFL, and that conversation and kind of like this new slate of topics we're talking about today kind of brings me to another topic that I kind of wanted to see if you had any kind of like insight into. So like when you're a GM, let's say you're Nick Caserio and you're signing guys in free agency, and is CJ Stroud's impending free agency in what, 4 seasons from now, is that a sticking point? Is that a conversation point in these negotiations where Casario's like, hey, we're going to sign Danielle Hunter here, or we're going to trade for Joe Mixon with money, with guaranteed money still on his contract and stuff. Is that something that they're in the back of their mind? They're like, all right, well, I have CJ pretty much free for the next 4 years. I'm going to stack up my guaranteed money in the next 4 years. And then in turn, do agents of players use that as leverage? Well, they could be like, well, I know you have CJ Stroud coming up in 4 years. I can get guaranteed money in the fifth year of my deal from another franchise that doesn't have a franchise quarterback coming guaranteed money coming due. Does that ever come up in a conversation? And how does that leverage kind of work between an agent and a GM when you're in the situation of a kind of rookie quarterback, rookie deal could be kind of a big spender and a big wallet in the market?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a multi-tiered answer, Joe. But what I will say is that every decision that the general manager makes when they have who they believe is their franchise quarterback on the rookie contract flows from the financials of that quarterback's contract. So that's to say that, yes, everything that Nick Caserio did in free agency was stemming off the fact that he does not have to pay CJ Stroud. He does not have to worry about the quarterback position, at least for the next, you know, 2 years. They'll probably have to give Stroud a contract after his third season, even though they technically don't have to until a year later. But yeah, everything flows from that. So their strategy when he works with his salary cap manager is, well, look, we can allocate X amount of dollars to this particular position because the quarterback is a non-issue. We don't have to pay the quarterback in 2024, 2025. So the contract structures for a Joe Mixon, you know, for Hunter, for Autry, you know, anybody who signs a multi-year contract with the Texans right now, absolutely is linked, even if it's not a direct link, but indirectly linked in some way to CJ Stroud's contractual situation. That's the only way that you can succeed as a franchise. And unless you're an inept GM who can't, you know, look more than 1 year ahead, you're going to make all of these plans and these contingencies. So it's funny because it's 2024 right now, right? So after the 2025 season is when CJ Stroud in all likelihood will get a new contract, but the free agents that they signed in the 2024 offseason play a role in you know, how they design and build their team. So yeah, is it at the forefront of his mind? Of course it is. Now, is he discussing the particulars of that with Joe Mixon's agent? No, he's not, or Hunter's agent. No, I think there's an implicit understanding when you're an agent for a free agent like Joe Mixon or Hunter, they know that there's more money that could be spent because the quarterback's not getting that money. And will they use that as leverage? I think they would use it as leverage, but not overtly. It's not like the agent would say to the general manager, well, you're not paying Stroud, so why don't you give, you know, my client an extra, you know, $2 to $4 million guarantee. That's not how it works. I think there's an implicit understanding because nobody's stupid. The agents aren't stupid. The franchises aren't stupid. But there's a clear understanding that, you know, this team is going to have more access to cash because they're not paying that big money to the quarterback. Yeah. Now, it's interesting that you mentioned Mixon. Mixon actually was their second choice. If it was up to them, they would have paid big money for Saquon Barkley. Yeah.
Do we already know that? Is that
they
on
were,
me?
In, they were yeah. in on him. They were
yeah,
in.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that maybe a week or so ago, Barkley even said that he initially thought he was going to go to the Texans, but the Eagles came over the top with their contract and with their guaranteed money. But I would say that when the tampering period began, unofficially before the tampering period, but let's just say, for argument's sake, when the tampering period began, Saquon Barkley thought he was going to go to the Texans, which would have made that offense even scarier than it is. Because even though I think that, Joe Mixon still could be a quality player, I do think that, he's on the wrong side of his career. He's on the downside of his career. Whereas I do think that Barkley still has, two, maybe 3 years of top end play left.
Bro, Barkley, Stroud, and Diggs. Oh my goodness, dude! Oh my goodness.
Oh yeah, not to mention the two young receivers that they have that have shown a lot of promise.
Tank Dell and Nico Collins are your second and third. Where your fourth option is Saquon out of the backfield is absolutely absurd. Something you said there. Oh, it was something dumb I wanted to say. You were like, they don't overtly. Like, use it as dude, fucking me, just close Art of the Deal, Chapter 2, would have been fucking up there and be like, hey, I know you got a fucking rookie quarterback up there. You better throw the bag down on the desk right now or we're walking the hell away. That's why.
I honestly, Joe, I do think lighthearted conversations like that do happen at the combine, but it's not something that an agent would repeatedly throw in a general manager's face. When they're having a couple beers at the combine and they're joking around, that type of lighthearted tone, I'm sure that happens. In fact, I know that happens.
So these guys are like getting after it at the combine. Maybe not getting after, it's the wrong term, but these guys are like going out, getting steak dinners, maybe a couple tequilas. Like, this is what they like, that's legitimate. Like, guys like kind of mix it up like that. And I know you kind of detailed how like those transactions kind of come to light. But is that true? Like maybe a transaction comes to light over maybe two GMs weren't even thinking about it, or a GM and a scout weren't even thinking about it, but they just get a good steak dinner in Indy. Indy's known for a steak dinner. They go to, they get a good steak dinner in Indy. Maybe they lift that smoke glass off the whiskey with the one ice cube in the middle. And then maybe they get a little loose lips sink ships. And then maybe kind of stuff happens that way. They make movies about that shit, but is that right, actually so I how wanna, it happens?
Yeah, that's mostly how it happens. If you're at the combine, it's actually kind of funny because I don't know if you guys have ever been to the combine, but there's a network of hotels that are connected to the Indiana Convention Center that really lead up to the stadium. There's a lot of restaurants that are connected to the hotels or within the hotels. So if you're walking around, even during the day, random time, anytime, 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, whatever it might be, you could walk into a restaurant and see a head coach or a general manager, having lunch or breakfast with an agent. Now, obviously, the prominent agents represent more than one player, but if you're smart, you have an idea of what players are represented by which particular agent and which of those players are free agents. So you can sit down, and I've seen Belichick a couple times with a high profile agent, and I knew who the agents, impending free agents were. So you get a better sense of, no, it wasn't Rosenhaus. Okay. You get a sense of like, ooh, the Patriots might be interested in player A, B, or C, because these are the high profile guys that this agent represents. Now, what I'll tell you is, this is an unusual story. This happened actually not at the combine, but at the league meetings, which is a couple weeks, maybe a month or so after the combine, second week of free agency, essentially. There was a owner's meeting in, I think it was Orlando. And I went to the bathroom. It was, midnight, 11:30, whatever. It was late. And I'm in the urinal, and next to me is a very well-respected head coach. He's still a head coach in the NFL. A winner, a Super Bowl winning head coach. And he is having a discussion in the adjacent urinal with a high profile agent. And so I'm in there. I had not met the head coach before. So it's the first time I saw the head coach. And you go into a bathroom, you kind of, I mean, I don't know how you guys do it, but I'm, you know, I got tunnel vision. Oh, yeah. I'm looking straight ahead. I'm not having a conversation.
You know me. I'm probably holding fucking court in there.
I'm not doing that. But these two guys, and when I say high profile agent, I mean one of the best agents that the NFL has had over the last, you know, 20 years, and a Super Bowl winning head coach who's still head coach in the league. They were having a discussion about one of the agent's players who was a free agent. He had not been signed during the initial wave of free agency. So clearly he wasn't a high sought after free agent, but still a guy who was still out there. And they had a discussion in there. They were in mid discussion when I got in there, and they closed the deal. They literally closed the deal while they were both in the bathroom. And then while I was in the urinal, the agent who was between me and the coach said hi to me. And again, I'm usually, do my business and get out of there. But I obviously acknowledged him and I said, hi, how you doing? He introduced me to the head coach while all three of us were in the urinal. Then they proceeded to continue the conversation. They had the conversation. They finished the conversation. We all came out, roughly the same time. The head coach, he shakes my hand, says to me, it was really nice meeting you. And then he says something to the agent, and he like basically puts his hands on both of our shoulders and says, that was a really good piss. And then he leaves. And then a week later, the team signed this impending free agent. So they made the deal in the bathroom at the league meetings. It's one of my favorite stories.
That is awesome.
Yeah, and trust me, you would. I don't know if you know the agent by name, because everybody knows Drew Rosenhaus, but this guy's, really well known in NFL circles. You obviously would know who the head coach was, and you would know who the player was. It was a wide receiver. So when I say that things happen in odd ways and unconventional ways, in terms of how deals get done in free agency, that to me is the strangest. And it's a story I love telling a lot of my friends, because it's not something that I've ever seen before. It was a once in a lifetime situation. All right. that things get done in odd ways.
So my takeaway from this is that we got to camp out in these bathrooms during the combine. That's the only takeaway I'm getting from that.
I have another, and I can share this story because there's no transaction.
Keep pumping. This is your story.
At the owners meetings in Arizona, it was a different year. I was in the bathroom finishing up, washing my hands, and Daniel Snyder and the team president that he didn't get along with, I can't remember what his name is now. He was with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and then he was the team president for Washington. Anyway, the two of them walked in, and Daniel Snyder had a big cut on his finger, and they were trying to stop the bleeding. And so I had never met Daniel Snyder before, and I turned around and I said, "Do you need a Band-Aid?" And he said, "Yeah, that'd be great." So I happen to have a Band-Aid in my wallet. I always have a Band-Aid. That's one of the three quirks. And I gave him a Band-Aid.
Number two, keep the Band-Aid in your wallet.
Yeah, he gave me a really strange look, and he thanked me, and he put the Band-Aid on. And so those are my two lavatory interactions.
That's fucking awesome, dude.
Oh, man.
Dude, I wanted to ask about the urinal situation and be like, what was the spacing like? Was everybody at a urinal next to each other?
Yeah, it wasn't one of those weird things, and it wasn't a trough, because that would have really.
Oh, dude, if it was a trough, this would be a way better story.
They were evenly spaced, and you had the wall in between. So, unless you're really being aggressive, you kind of just stay in your own lane, so to speak, and do what you got to do. But
sword fighting, discussing 6-round draft picks. I'm sorry, getting off the rails here, but let's holy shit, we get off the rails here.
We're good.
It wasn't my fault this time. It is talking fast.
You had mentioned deals getting done over lunch and dinner and things like that, and drinks. And so I had to. I mean, this is obviously the weirdest transaction that I've ever been a part of.
We need all of those stories. Whenever that little light bulb for you goes off, man, just fucking you just mute all of us and you go, bro. That's
fucking awesome. So let's try to transition out of the Texans here, and let's get back to the piece de resistance. I feel like their offseason, Stephon Diggs. So he goes for a second round draft pick, but he came back. Oh, was it a fifth round draft pick?
It was a 2025 second rounder.
That's what it was. Next year, second round draft pick, and then he went with a fifth round pick.
Yeah, it was a second and a sixth for the fifth and Diggs.
Right. You know what, man?
I'm going to let you take this one away. This is your second favorite football team. This is your favorite wide receiver in the league. So I'll let you take this one, this part of the segment away here, kid.
I'm going to start off by saying I absolutely love this trade. Not only because we are a pro Texans podcast, as we were all of last year, but I absolutely hate the Buffalo Bills. Like, there's no team in the NFL that I hate more than that team in Western New York. I hate their fans. I have too many of them in my life that like to talk shit when the Patriots are going on their run, and I would always fall into it and take the bait, and it's ruined it. I don't care that they've never won. I don't care that they jump through tables or any of that. But the impacts of this trade to the Bills, especially after Gabe Davis walked in free agency.
That was a great pun, Parrish. I'm sorry. I don't care if they jump through tables, but you say the impact of this trade. Like, great job, dude.
A1. That's all. I'll take credit for it, dude.
A1, bro.
My question for you, Manish, would be, what do you see the Bills doing to get Josh Allen another weapon to make me continue to hate them because they're good? Like, are they going to make a trade at the draft? Are they going to trade up in the draft to draft a wide receiver? I mean, because their wide receiver room has nobody now. So they need to get some – they have to do something.
Yeah, I would assume that they would draft a wide receiver in one of the first two rounds of the draft. I mean, right now, you know, as much of a believer in Dalton Kincaid as I am, I don't think that he can be – a Travis Kelce type of player just yet in his career. I mean, ultimately, I think he's going to be an incredible player if he stays healthy, because he's more, you know, he is more of a wide receiver type than, you know, a traditional blocking type of receiver now, pass catcher. But he's obviously going to have an increased role. They added Curtis Samuel. I don't know if that necessarily moves the needle for Buffalo. You know, Cook, I think, was pretty good in his first full season as a starter and running back. But they clearly need another dynamic option, or Josh Allen, you know, is not going to be able to take them where they, you know, where they expect to go. I don't think there's any kind of like magic formula here where they're going to magically make a trade for Justin Jefferson or anything like that. So the answer, you know, to your question has to be in the draft. I mean, they have to address the position in either the first round or the second round. And I think it's a pretty deep wide receiver draft. I'd be lying to you if I told you I knew every wide receiver in this class, but you know, the NFL has proven that you can get difference making wide receivers, if not clearly in the first round, but you can definitely get a guy in the second round. So I would assume that one of their first two picks would be a wide receiver. You know, and Joe Shane said as much, not Joe Shane, their general manager, you know, said as much, that they're not as good today as they were yesterday. Now, you know, just to play devil's advocate a little bit, as much as I love the move for the Texans, you know, there's a couple issues at play. One, I'm not really certain why the Texans voided the last 3 years of Diggs's deal. I mean, you could say that could make Diggs more motivated because he's playing for a contract essentially, but you could also say, because there are so many options for CJ Stroud, if Diggs doesn't get the volume that he expects, you know, even in a quote unquote down year this past year, he had over 100 catches. So if he doesn't get that volume and he walks in free agency, then you're the Texans and you give up a second round pick for a guy that was a 1 year rental. So I don't know if that's so great from a Bills perspective. I mean, I know you don't like the Bills, but if you do look at Diggs's production, as a whole, again, great, you know, 1,100, 1,200 yards, over 100 catches. His yards per catch were the lowest it's been since he's been with Buffalo. He is going to be 31, I think, at some point during the season. If you're honest with yourself, in the last month and a half of the season, it looked like he lost the gear. I don't think he was hurt, but he clearly wasn't the same player. I don't believe he even scored in the last month and a half of the season. So, I mean, are the Bills getting out maybe a year too early before the wheels fall off? You know, that's a tactic that a lot of teams do. The Eagles did that for, you know, a decade plus. It's better to trade a guy, you know, a year early than a year too late. All that being said, clearly the Bills are going to miss him. Losing Gabe Davis doesn't help matters either. So they're going to have to get some kind of additional offensive weapon for Josh Allen, and I think it has to be in one of the first two rounds of the draft.
I definitely want to see, like, I know that Stephon Diggs and Josh Allen's relationship seemed to deteriorate over the course of that season, which kind of coincided with the dip in production. So I wonder how much that relationship and the fact that maybe it couldn't have been repaired, because you always used to see them yelling at each other on the sidelines. It was pretty common throughout the year last year. So do you think that that played a part into them moving on? I would say maybe a small part, but like, do you think it was a major part?
I definitely don't think it was a significant part. I know there's a story out there that Josh Allen snapped at Diggs in the locker room after their week one loss in overtime to the Jets. I don't make anything of that. I've been in locker rooms where players who are best friends, you know, snap at each other after the game for a number of different reasons.
Who are you most comfortable getting mad at?
What's that?
You are most comfortable getting mad at the people you're closest with.
Exactly.
Have the most frank conversations with my best of friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally, you're at 1,000,000,000% right. It's just funny, like in this day and age of social media, even when guys are on the sideline and they're jawing at each other, we have no idea what the context is. We have no idea what they're actually saying. A lot of guys, and I think Diggs falls into this category, you know, they're really passionate, and it may seem like they're, you know, yelling at their quarterback, but
or a diva, whatever bullshit.
Right, exactly. But the reality, the fact is that he's trying to pump up his quarterback, or he's trying to pump up himself, or he's trying to pump up both of them. So without context, I think a lot of the things that we see on television, on the sideline between players, is, you know, overblown or just completely mischaracterized because we don't have the full information. So I don't think that any kind of great divide between Josh Allen and Stephon Diggs prompted this trade. I think a number of factors played into it. Chief among them for Buffalo was getting a second round pick. I know it's not in 2024. You'd love to have that obviously in hand right now. But the fact that they get a guaranteed 2025 second round pick is gold. I mean, a second round pick for a soon to be 31-year-old player, unless it's a quarterback, I think it's great return, to be honest with you.
I think it could be a high second round pick too, because it's Minnesota's pick. So they don't have a quarterback right now. So who knows what they're gonna look like next year.
Oh, good call, Bish. Good call.
Right. I mean, unless of course Minnesota trades up with your team and ends up getting their franchise quarterback.
Whoa, dude. Whoa. I don't want to have my laptop on the front lawn just yet. Hogan, I know you had a couple words you wanted to get in here, bud.
Just real quick, Manisha, we're talking about, you know, the demise of Buffalo, which I know gets Burgess all excited. I guess my question for you, especially being a former Jets guy with everything, especially with Aaron Rodgers' potential comeback and all that, with the Bills losing as much as they did on defense with Tre'Davious White, Poyer, an aging Von Miller, and then now with the offensive woes that they seem to have out of nowhere.
Kiko Alonso back from a big injury too. Sorry, I didn't mean
it. Oh, yeah. I guess my question is, does this set the bar for the Jets to actually take over the division, or do you think that Miami kind of still has the rope on that where they brought it down to the wire with the Bills last year? But everybody kind of forgets about the Jets, where you take away the four plays with Aaron Rodgers, and it's like they were the same old Jets that we're used to, but if he stays healthy, that Jets team actually scares me, which I never thought I would say, you know, in this, you know, lifetime. But what do you think?
Well, I would put Miami as a favorite to win the division. The Jets are just a wild card. I mean, I think it's pretty apparent that, you know, the Patriots are in a transition period, rebuilding period, however you want to frame it. The Bills took a step back, but they clearly have the best quarterback, in my estimation, in the division. So you don't want to count them out. The Jets, to me, there's so many X factors, wild cards, uncertainties. They've got, you know, 3/5 of their offensive line, 60% of their offensive line is new. Two of them are 33-year-old tackles. One of them is going to be a 34-year-old tackle during the season in Tyron Smith. Tyron Smith has missed more games over the last 4 seasons than he's played. Everybody knows what his injury history is. You know,
keep spitting, keep spitting, dude. Yes, dude. Yeah, and he's a guy, Smith is injury prone, dude. That dude sucks.
Yeah, and look, I think that the Cowboys frankly had enough. I mean, they're obviously he's a lifelong Cowboy. He's going to go in that Ring of Honor. He's going to be he's going to be an NFL Hall of Famer. I think that goes without saying. Nobody's debating what his resume is, but the question becomes, what kind of player is he now? Clearly, the Cowboys didn't value him to the point where they would, you know, match what the Jets offered. But again, a guy who's missed more games than he's played the last four seasons. Last year, he didn't even practice. They basically said, hey, play on Sunday, go through the walkthroughs, play on Sunday again. And he played most of the season. I think he missed a couple games, but by and large, you know, he played most of the season. So that's the type of load management that the Jets are going to have to employ for him. But again, almost a 34-year-old injured player. Was he great? Absolutely. The Tyron Smith I remember was, you know, a guy you couldn't get around if you're an edge pass rusher. He's not the same player now. Morgan Moses, on the other side, a 33-year-old right tackle who had offseason pecs, the player that he was, I think, a year and a half, 2 years ago when the Jets had him. So you're relying on two old players at tackle. You've got a new guard and Joe Simpson, who also came over from the Ravens, along with Moses. Moses was a trade, and Simpson was a free agent signing. Simpson's a guy who had 11 penalties, which was the fourth most among any offensive lineman in the NFL last year. He had seven holding calls, the most among any guard in the NFL. So, yeah, is he a new player at guard for the Jets? Yes, he is. Is he an upgrade just because he was a starter on a great Ravens team? I can't say that with certainty. Maybe he is, but clearly he was a player that Eric DaCosta thought was expendable because they didn't make any kind of real move to bring him back. So 60% of your offensive line is new. You've got a 40-year-old quarterback, soon to be 41 later in the season, coming off a torn Achilles. And, you know, a torn Achilles isn't an ankle sprain. It isn't even a bone break. If it was, like 5 years ago or so when Aaron Rodgers broke it, or maybe it was longer, 78 years ago when he broke his clavicle, you could say, okay, you know what? Bones heal. And, yeah, he's 40, he's 41, so he's not going to be the same player he was. But, the clavicle is not going to be an issue. I can't say the same thing when it comes to an Achilles repair. I have no idea what kind of Aaron Rodgers we're going to see, because if we are, again, being blunt about it, he wasn't particularly good or great, I should say, in his last season with Green Bay. He dealt with two injuries and people will say, well, he wasn't fully healthy. And to that, I would respond, well, what do you expect? At that point, he was 38 years old. He's now 40, soon to be 41. That's what happens to older players. They get nicked up. So, yeah, in a perfect world, in a vacuum, if you could get a fully healthy Aaron Rodgers playing like he did 3 years ago, I would agree with you and say the Jets are very dangerous. But you have to be realistic. I mean, these guys, just like the four of us here, I mean, we're not same amount of shape as we were when we were younger. Now, look, these guys are world-class athletes. Aaron Rodgers, obviously way more athletic at 40 than I'll ever be in my life, but yeah, everything is relative, you know? Everything's relative. So you've got the quarterback question, first and foremost. You've got the uncertainty at offensive line with two older tackles, three new starters. How long does it take for them to gel? You still have a problem at your second wide receiver option. They signed Mike Williams, and look, I mean, no disrespect to Mike Williams. Mike Williams has been in this league for, what, 6 or 7 years? He's not a Pro Bowl caliber player. He's coming off an ACL injury in which the Jets themselves, Robert Saleh himself, told you that they hope he's ready for week one. I don't know if he's going to be ready for week one. If he is ready for week one, what kind of Mike Williams are we going to see in the first half of the season? What kind of Mike Williams are we going to see the entire season? Because how many wide receivers can you name who are around 30? I think Mike Williams is 29 or 30, coming off an ACL injury, who are going to be difference-making players in their first year back from the ACL. I mean, I can't think of any. I'm not saying that there aren't, but nobody really comes to mind. So it's an interesting team because on paper you see names like Aaron Rodgers, Tyron Smith, even Morgan Moses. You know, fantasy football players still want to believe that Mike Williams is good. That's fine. But there's a lot of recognizable names that make you think, wow, you know, the Jets could be scary. And if everything breaks right and all of these guys are healthy and Aaron Rodgers returns to form when he won back-to-back MVPs, which is now 3 years removed, by the way, then I agree with you. The Jets are, you know, a dangerous team because their defense is solid. And I don't think their defense is a top three defense. I think they're closer to like a 5-10 defense. Regardless, the defense is a defense that you can go deep in the playoffs with. Sure. The question marks are all on offense. You're coming off a historically bad offense. And I just think it's dangerous to assume that you're going to get the Aaron Rodgers that you think of when you think of Aaron Rodgers. You know, I think of Aaron Rodgers. He's the best quarterback that I have seen in my lifetime from an athletic standpoint. Obviously not the winner that Tom Brady was, but I think that at his peak, nobody in my life is better than Aaron Rodgers playing that position. But that's not the Aaron Rodgers that we're going to get because it's 2024. He's going to be 41. He's coming off an Achilles. Those are all factors that you just can't dismiss. And that, look, I applaud Jet fans for trying to be hopeful and optimistic. You know, Lord knows they probably deserve better. They haven't made the playoffs in 13 years, the longest playoff drought in North American sports history. They have the second worst winning percentage in all of sports in the last 10 years, only second only to Jacksonville. So look, they're starving. They're starving to cling to hope and to cling to something. So for their benefit, I hope it works out for the Jets. But I think if you're looking at this objectively, while there are some big names on that roster, specifically on the offensive side, you can't discount injury and age when it comes to, you know, what you believe this team's going to be able to do in 2024.
So if you thought this fucking podcast was sponsored by Crisco before, after that diatribe, we have
doubled down and tripled down and extended our sponsorship forever. I'm not going to get into that. But what I do want to ask is, maybe this is a good tailored question for you specifically with your kind of where your basis of knowledge is at. It is specifically about the Aaron Rodgers situation and more specifically about a veteran quarterback and how much decision-making power that they have in an organization. I think that last year you could see that Aaron Rodgers had, I mean, overtly a pretty decent amount of decision-making power, or at least a decent amount of leverage in the organization to get certain people that he wanted onto the roster. And what I want to dovetail about that is, have you seen maybe this is a Tom Brady question, but have you seen a quarterback more involved in a roster composition standpoint be successful? And do you think that the Jets are towing that line properly?
Well, I think if you look at Tom Brady's final couple seasons in Tampa, you know, they brought Gronk in for him. That worked out because Gronk was good. So once you reach a certain status, you know, in your career as a quarterback, and it's only reserved for a handful of guys. So it's only reserved for the Peyton Mannings, the Tom Brady's, the Aaron Rodgers, you know, of this generation. So it's not a long list. So if you're Aaron Rodgers, you feel that you can, you know, have a little bit of say and a little bit of pull. Now, I think this notion that he's the general manager, the assistant general manager, I mean, I think that's unfair to the general manager, to the current general manager of the Jets. I think it's unfair to the front office. If you look at what they did, they brought in guys who, you know, probably didn't deserve a roster spot. They clearly signed Alan Lazard to a contract that he, you know, should not have gotten. So they overpaid for Lazard, but they wanted Lazard there because Aaron Rodgers felt comfortable, you know, with him in terms of throwing to him in actual games. Whereas Randall Cobb, I think everybody knew that he was on his last legs and he wasn't going to offer much on the field. But I think there's some intangibles, great leader, reputation of being a great locker room guy. They brought him in. It was cheap. They brought in a rotational backup offensive lineman who wasn't really good, that Rodgers was familiar with, and Nathaniel Hackett was familiar with in Green Bay. So, you know, I think some of that stuff was overblown just because they didn't really break the bank for anyone other than Alan Lazard, who Rodgers was, you know, vouching for. And as I said that, I have to correct myself. There was a second guy that they vastly overpaid for because Rodgers wanted him to be a part of the team, and that's Dalvin Cook, and he was clearly cooked. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they wasted $7 or $8 million. So that was a mistake. So, you know, paying Dalvin Cook.
Do you know that Dalvin Cook was specifically a Rodgers signing?
I think Dalvin Cook was a player that Aaron Rodgers wanted, and I think it also helped out that the Jets were hedging their bets because they didn't know how quickly Breece Hall would be able to recover from his ACL. They wanted to kind of load management him through the first month or so of the season, not give him 20, 25 touches week one, which I think is a smart move. I mean, I think philosophically that makes a lot of sense. They felt like Cook could, you know, take some of the load off. Unfortunately, Cook just doesn't have – he didn't have any tread left on the tires. But Cook is a player that Aaron Rodgers wanted. He's a player that Aaron Rodgers respects, obviously being that in the NFC North for, you know, all those years together. So, I mean, would they have signed Dalvin Cook if Aaron Rodgers wasn't on the team? I mean, that's hard to say, but I think that that signing clearly got Aaron Rodgers' endorsement and blessing. And again, you know, that was a significant error on their part. So, I think that Aaron Rodgers had influence. But in terms of the backup quarterback situation, which is, I think, what you initially asked me, to be honest, I think that was more of the general manager in the front office wanting to hold on to Zach Wilson and believing in Zach Wilson more than they should have. They probably should have cut the cord. But I think it was more about that than not signing a veteran in the offseason. Now, the mistake that the Jets made, and I don't believe it had anything to do with Aaron Rodgers, was that after he was injured, there was an opportunity to get Joe Flacco. There was an opportunity to maybe trade for a backup quarterback, maybe get Jacoby Brissett, you know, some veteran guy. Instead, they doubled down on Zach Wilson being the second, being the backup, partly because, you know, the general manager drafts him with the number two overall pick. It clearly hadn't worked out to that point. And now, you know, Rodgers goes down. Maybe this is an opportunity for, you know, Zach Wilson to not only get redemption, but the front office and the organization to get some redemption as well. So, you know, I wouldn't pin that on Rodgers. And I've been critical of Aaron Rodgers for a number of different reasons, some that have to do with, you know, what he does from a football perspective, and some, you know, about what he has said, which I think is hypocritical about, you know, outside noise and cutting out distractions when, you know, the reality is he's been the number one distraction. So I've been critical about that, but I do want to be fair and say the fact that they didn't sign a backup quarterback after he was injured, I think that was more about the organization doubling down on Zach Wilson and hoping that that Zach Wilson could salvage his career with the Jets more than anything else.
Yeah, great point, man. And it's like, don't pay no attention to this man going into the ayahuasca hut. I'm still going to play quarterback for you. I promise.
He's just so contrived. He's just like the classic rich dude that just
wants to like sound interesting and wants to sound deep. When you're actually just a douche, you have nothing to do besides go to ayahuasca retreats when you're like not playing. Dude, if I had fucking 3 months off, like in between my jobs, dude, I'd be going to drug huts and doing crazy shit like that too. Anyway,
Like a bow on this, I don't want to, you know, elongate this Aaron Rodgers conversation, but it is fascinating to me because there are teammates, and I'm discounting what Marcus Valdes-Scantling said recently about Rodgers being a great teammate because Valdes-Scantling's looking for a job, so he could be just placating to Rodgers. But you have heard players say that Aaron Rodgers, not Jet players, but Packers players, say that Aaron Rodgers is a good teammate. But you've also heard some of the younger players say that there's a disconnect between Rodgers and them. So, you know, there's a lot of different sides to every person. I don't want to paint a broad brush and say Aaron Rodgers is a horrible person, a horrible teammate. I think that's unfair. I also don't want to paint him as this like incredible team first guy, because if he were that, he would have actually shown up for offseason workouts when the Packers had these young receivers as opposed to taking 3 months off. So a lot of different dimensions to him. I think he's fascinating in a lot of different ways. I have a lot of sharp opinions about him, but that's probably a different discussion for a different day.
We'll just start a conspiracy theory podcast, and it's just going to be specifically Minutia and Aaron Rodgers takes. That's it.
Yeah.
It's just
going to be them two. Special edition podcast? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, put them two in a room and just shake it like a barrel of hornets and just let them go. But that's good. No, you are pro. You will mitigate the Aaron Rodgers hate. I will not. I will spearhead it. But that's a totally different, like you said, totally different conversation for a totally different day. But we'll stick to the AFC East. I want to stick on our favorite team real quick, the Patriots. So ended up giving a bag to Kyle Duggar, 4 years, $58 million, $32.5 million guaranteed. We in the group chat, nobody was over their heels about it. Over the hills about it, and nobody was really super down about it. We were all kind of in the ballpark of that's a big contract to give up a kind of one-dimensional player. But if he does end up improving, and if he does end up adding different aspects to his game, mm-hmm. it could end up being a real steal in the long run. But it does bring up the caveat, the fact that you fire Bill Bakers, relax, put the Crisco away. We're sponsored, but you got to use it after the episode. But it does bring up the caveat and the fact that you kind of usher Bill Belichick out because he's not retaining any of his talent he drafts. He's not doing all these things. And then you end up retaining all the talent that he's drafted in the last 2 years. They kind of one fell swoop in one offseason with the Unwenu deal, with the Duggar deal. Then you have Uche. You have a couple other guys who are all coming back. And this is kind of the first – I would put Unwenu in the team-friendly deal category just based on how good he is and what the market looks like right now. But, I mean, the Duggar deal is the first one that I would say was above market value for a limited player. What do you feel like the Patriots strategy approaching this offseason is? And then what do you kind of relate that specifically to the Duggar signing?
You know, I actually like the Duggar signing. I agree with you that maybe I would not have predicted that type of money for him. But there is something to be said, as you touched on, in retaining your own guys. He's a good culture guy, and Gerard Mayo is trying to build a new culture, even though he has been with the franchise for several years. So while I agree with your assessment of him of Duggar as a player, you know, retaining a guy who you think can evolve as a player, one of your guys who can grow and evolve as a player, I think is important. I mean, you can't just continually let guys that you draft go and bring in new faces every year in free agency. So there is value in that. So while I agree that maybe on paper the deal was really player friendly, I do think there's a lot of value in retaining you know, one of your own. And when you, as you said it perfectly, I actually thought that was a great deal for the team. You know, not only because of his position flexibility, just the quality of player he is, you know, the dearth of players of that age, at that position, you know, at that money, I think that was a great deal. I actually thought, you know, because he was represented by himself, that maybe he might make a bad deal with another team. And I'm not saying he made a bad deal for himself because, you know, he got the guaranteed money. But I do think that was a deal that the Patriots are probably, you know, really extremely happy with, you know, retain him. I mean, the work's not done. I mean, I think they still need an offensive tackle. We'll see what happens in the draft. But it's interesting, if you just listen to this week, the Gerard Mayo's messaging, he is telling you that this is going to be a rebuilding year without saying rebuilding. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's alluding to the fact that if they draft a quarterback, he might sit for a year. You know, specifically mentioning that Nick Caserio didn't turn around the Texans in 1 year. I think he was looking more at the 2022 Texans, who had Davis Mills as their quarterback and only won three games, versus the 2023 Texans with C.J. Stroud, who obviously made waves and are now like the it teams in the NFL. So I think what Mayo was trying to say is that this is going to be a bridge year. Maybe it's a bridge year with Jacoby Brissett as your quarterback for much of the season, if you even if you draft a quarterback. Now, if you don't draft a quarterback, you could really, you know, plug up a lot of holes and really beefing up your nucleus. You know, I don't know what you guys have, you know, said about this or think about this. I know that we touched on this way back, you know, a couple months ago when I was on. You know, if the Patriots believe in one of these quarterbacks, whether it's you know, Drake May or even J.J. McCarthy, who I'm not a believer in, but you know, if the Patriots, if Elliott Wolf and Gerard Mayo believe in a quarterback, then I think it's a no-brainer. You draft a quarterback. But if you're not really sold on a quarterback and you think it's going to be like, you know, 2011 with Christian Ponder, Jake Locker, you know, that fiasco of a quarterback draft, or the one a few years ago with, you know, with Zach Wilson and Justin Fields, or even the Sam Darnold draft in, what, 18, 19, when you had Darnold and Josh Rosen and, you know, things didn't really work out for Baker Mayfield at one. If you think that there are enough question marks at the quarterback who's going to be available, or the quarterbacks who are going to be available, I just think that you really have to take advantage and trade down and get assets, especially since every indication is that Minnesota is so thirsty for a quarterback at 11, and they've got the 11th and the 23rd pick.
Hold on, Manish. I gotta stop you right there. You've left too many. It's fucking Hansel and Gretel out here. You've left too many motherfucking breadcrumbs out there before we started the episode, when we were texting the other day, the beginning of this episode, and then right now. Spill the effing beans, bro. Tell me what. Don't get yourself in trouble. Don't fucking out yourself on the podcast. But I need to know a little bit more about what you're getting at right there, because that's the third friggin' time in 45 minutes that you've referenced that. So I need to know what you.
I don't know what Elliot Wolf is thinking. I don't know what Gerard Mayo is thinking. But what I will tell you is that if there's doubt, you have a team who is so clearly desperate to move up. And when it's all said and done, frankly, I'd be stunned if Minnesota didn't make a heavy play to move up to the New England spot. And if the Patriots say, no, we're going to take a quarterback, then I think the Vikings are going to make the same offer, a similar offer to the team picking right behind the Patriots, the Cardinals at 4, who I know are looking to, you know, consider their options in trading down, because they clearly obviously don't need a quarterback with Kyler Murray there. So, again, I don't know what Gerard Mayo is thinking. I don't know what Elliot Wolf is thinking, but I do know that if you have a team with the 11th and 23rd picks in the draft, and you could conceivably get both of those picks plus a first round pick and more next year, I mean, I would take it. I mean, again, unless you think that Drake May, JJ McCarthy, or Jaden Daniels, whoever, you know, whichever those two are there, if you think that one of those guys, two of those guys is a legit franchise quarterback, and you're not just taking a quarterback, you're not just taking Jake Locker or Christian Ponder because you need a quarterback, but if you legitimately think in a vacuum that one of these guys is your answer, then you don't, you know, then you listen to the offer, and you stand pat and you take the quarterback. If not, you could really revamp your team quickly, really quickly. Just think about this. The 11th pick, the 23rd pick, the number one pick of the Vikings in 2025, maybe the third round pick in 2025. I mean, you could have a stockpile of assets that if you make the right decision in the draft, you could really flip your team quickly, and it could be a scenario like the Texans. Now, the big hole is you still need a quarterback, and when's the next time the Patriots are going to be picking in the top five? So there's that argument. But, it, you know, when people say that to me, it makes sense, you know, theoretically. But if you don't believe in the quarterback, you can't force the pick, because if you force the pick, you're going to ruin your team. You're going to ruin your franchise for the next 5+ years. So, again, I'm not there at these pro days. I don't know what Mayo thinks. I don't know, you know, what Alex Van Pelt thinks. And most importantly, I don't know what Elliot Wolf thinks about these quarterbacks. If they're sold on them, go for it. But don't convince yourself into taking a quarterback because you need a quarterback. Because if you do that, that's the quickest way to ruin any chance of a rebuild for the foreseeable future.
Don't be so humble. Hold on. Don't be so humble, Manish, because I distinctively remember you saying that Caleb Williams was 100% the number one guy the last time when you guest starred with us, and it was like you were already saying Justin Fields was gone. So I'm going to be cursing you the minute the Patriots trade down. I'm telling you that right now. You've already guaranteed that they're trading down. That's what I'm taking away from this right now.
Look, the other factor here is I'm using the Vikings as an example because I know they want to move up. But even if you drop down three spots, let's say you drop down to six where the Giants are, and the Giants are looking for a quarterback, you could still pick up a first-round pick in 2025, and at six – you're going to get a great player.
I mean, any left tackle and any wide receiver that's not freaking Marvin Harrison Jr. would want at six.
Right. So in that scenario, the way you just described it, it's neighbors. It's the University of Washington wide receiver, probably neighbors, or Joe Walt. And Joe Walt's one of the cleanest prospects out there. And he can be your left tackle. And a
2025 first round pick.
Right. And you get a first round pick.
2025 first round.
I mean, to me, see, I'm a guy who likes to stockpile assets because – mm-hmm. If I'm a general manager, I have full belief in my ability to draft great players. Now, look, all this goes out the window if you draft guys that underperform. But what general manager in the NFL, which of the 32 guys, name me one who thinks I'm going to screw up this pick? Nobody thinks that. So if you get more assets, and it's honestly the Patriot way in many respects. The Patriots were all about taking as many swings as he possibly could. It's about quantity over, you know, lack quote-unquote quality. So if you take eight swings and you whiff on four of them and you nail four of them, you're still getting four great players as opposed to having only three swings. And maybe you hit on two of those three quality picks and you whiff on one. Would you rather have eight swings with four star players or three swings with two star players? I'd rather have the four star players. So, I mean, I've always been a quantity over quality guy because you got to have a lot of confidence and courage in your convictions as a general manager that, yeah, I can trade down to six. I can trade down to 11 and 23, and I'm going to get two starters, two day one starters at 11 and 23. I'm going to get a bona fide superstar at six. I mean, that's got to be the mentality. And again, to me, that's only relevant if you don't think one of these guys is going to be a superstar quarterback. Because if you do, you're crazy to pass up on a guy that you think is a stud. And I don't know what their mindset is, but if they're not sold, there's an opportunity there to really load up with assets because there are teams who are desperate and hungry to move up for a quarterback.
And I feel like that whole thing is like it brings a whole philosophical debate is like how much can a first-year quarterback change a team versus how much can hitting on a starter at 11 and 23 change a team? You know what I mean? Like as the Patriots are currently constituted, if you put anybody besides like fucking first year Peyton Manning or first year Joe Burrow or like fucking
or CJ Stroud.
If you drop that player and onto the Patriots roster right now, I don't think there's much they can do. You know what I mean? It might be a negative to drop them on the roster to their future development. But if you can trade back, get somebody at 11 and 23 and then use your two picks next year, that pick that you have from your bridge team, which is a maybe top 15 pick. And then you have another pick and maybe the mid-teens to low 20s, and then you could go back in for another quarterback. When you already got this souped-up roster that has a left tackle from the 11th pick and a wide receiver from the 23rd pick that have all turned out, so now you have a turnkey roster that you just need to – you don't need to draft the guy. You just need to draft a guy with your first pick. So I want to segment away from the draft talk where we get really heavy into this.
Manish, I hope you're available over the next couple of weeks. We'd love to have you on to just talk about team construction. Because, I mean, dude, I just ask you about what's it like whizzing at the owner's meeting. And you're like, dude, this guy crowds you at the urinal and he's looking up. No, I'm just fucking with you.
But no, we'll have to get you on to talk more draft stuff. And I don't even know if we'll even talk about like a single player. We'll just talk about what the stanchions are like. What the stanchions are like at Lucas Oil, what kind of flavor they got on the fucking the soap dispensers and shit like that. See what procures conversation down there.
I do want to say one thing. I know that you want to pivot off the draft, but there's one quick thing that I don't know if people were talking about it. It seemed pretty innocuous because you hear about players visiting with teams all the time. But something really struck me a couple of days ago when the reports came out that Marvin Harrison Jr. was visiting with the Bears. I think he visited with the Bears maybe Monday, yesterday, which is interesting because to me, that signals one of two things. Either the Cardinals are willing to trade down and or the Bears are willing to trade up because he's not going to make it to nine where the Bears are picking. He's clearly not going to be their number one pick. That's Caleb Williams. So if you're Marvin Harrison and his agent, you don't waste visits. These top 30 visits that teams want you to come in for, a lot of them are for medical checks, background checks, guys who have questionable issues. But the clean prospects, guys like Marvin Harrison, who have no chance of dropping to where you're picking at nine, don't waste their time. The agents do not waste their clients' times, a client like Marvin Harrison, to go to Chicago unless there's a real possibility that Chicago is exploring moving up, much like what the Texans did last year, and they had the second and third picks and took Stroud and Will Anderson. Could the Bears be willing to seriously consider moving up to take Marvin Harrison and or are the Cardinals seriously considering trading out of the pick so that Marvin Harrison would not be the fourth pick? J.J. McCarthy, in theory, would be the fourth pick to a team that moves up. So clearly, Marvin Harrison's agent believes there's a chance that he will not go four. And it wouldn't be because the Cardinals don't take him. It'd be because the Cardinals aren't picking. Or it'd be because the Bears are willing to move up. So I thought it was interesting that he is visiting a team that's picking ninth when clearly he has no chance of dropping that low.
Holy shit.
All right. So what you're telling me is there's just – I'm going to break it down in layman's terms, which is how I have to digest everything. So you're saying that this – so
My bird brain was like, oh, Marvin Harrison Jr. is going to the Bears' number one pick. Are they really going to pass on Caleb Williams? But you're obviously big brain side. You said that this signals to you a better chance of the Bears coming down from, even though they're picking at number one, the Bears coming down from 9 and right. picking again in the top 5 to get yes. Marvin Harrison.
Whoa.
Let's put it this way. Marvin Harrison and his camp didn't think that there was a possibility, a real possibility. And they talk. I mean, you know, agents talk with general managers. If they didn't think that was a real possibility, it's not to say that the Bears can pull it off, but if they didn't think it was a real possibility, they just simply would not waste their time going to Chicago for a visit. It makes no sense on any level. I've been around this long enough to know that if an agent believes that there's no chance his client is going to drop down to whatever number it's going to be, usually it's a quarterback, but in this case, obviously Marvin Harrison is, you know, probably the best non-quarterback, definitely the best skill position player on paper. The agent would not have his client get on a plane and go to Chicago unless he had an inkling that the Bears were serious threats to move up or the Cardinals were serious threats to move down, and the team that drops into the fourth position is not going to take Harrison. Obviously, they would trade up to 4 to take a quarterback.
Wow. See, this is what we keep you around for. This is what we keep you around for. It's just three dudes with a mic, and then we bring on the dude that actually knows what he's fucking talking about. This is the best. So I want to tap into one thing real quickly. Dude, we're already at a fucking hour already. It goes by so quick every time.
Yes, it does. So
I appreciate the insight you give, but I just want to, well, maybe pivot away from the draft talk, and I just want to pivot just into the rule changes. Obviously, we have a hot button issue that I'll let Burge get into, but maybe do you just want to start maybe on the kickoff and what you think about that, and then I'll kind of let Burge take you into the whole hip drop issue here.
I mean, I like the new rule for the kickoff. I mean,
hell yeah, me too. Thank you.
Because the way it was currently constituted was boring. It was just kind of you go through the motions, and I know that a lot of owners coming out of the owners' meetings made it a point to say there were no kickoff returns in the Super Bowl this past year. I think there were maybe 5 or 6 kickoffs, no returns. It's kind of a obligatory thing where team starts, you know, they start at the whatever 20, 25, whatever it was, without any kind of return. This, if you look at other league that did this, it's actually pretty exciting. I mean, I think it adds an element of excitement. It also gives another added weight to special teams, because I feel like special teams was kind of being phased out. I think that it'll lower the risk of injury because guys aren't running from 30 yards at full speed. They're not up to full speed yet just because of where they start. So I think it's an entertaining element to the game. I don't think it bastardizes the game in any way. It's not like you're asking, saying like a 60-yard field goal is worth 4 points instead of 3. It's nothing weird like that. So I think it's going to be fun. I think it'll be entertaining. I think the special teams coaches will enjoy it. There's a new strategy involved. It'll bring back a part of the game that was lost these last several years.
And we were of course, just gluttonous Patriots fans. We were like, we couldn't have kept Bill around for one more fucking
year. Yeah.
To see what he could put in the test tubes and the beakers and the fucking smelling salts that he could do on the sidelines and just get this shit cooking. But, Burrs, we got another rule change I wanted you to take us into.
So, yeah, I want to get your thoughts on the hip drop tackle being eliminated. From my standpoint, I think this is just another situation where the officials are going to have a subjective call in the game where it could impact the end result. Like, you could see it show up at the most inopportune time and end up having it factor into the end result of the game. And obviously, you'll get the conspiracy theorists coming out talking about the gambling side of things. Oh, they're making the call here because of this. I understand why they removed the rule, but for me personally, I can just see it becoming a problem. And I want to get what you have to say about that.
I agree with you in that you're going to have some inopportune times when that's called. I mean, it's kind of like, it's like calling a moving screen against the UConn women the other day.
Yes.
With like 10 seconds left, you know? It's like, you know, technically, was it the right call? I don't know. Maybe not. But you know, there's going to be a penalty at a really inopportune time late in the game where it's probably going to cost the team. Hopefully it doesn't happen that often. I would imagine that in the preseason that you would see a ton of flags for hip drops because they're going to want to ingrain in players the importance of not doing it. So they'll over officiate it in the preseason. And hopefully that gets through to players and teams so that they won't have to throw the flag as much. I don't think the players are going to – I mean, I think, you know, I think John Harbaugh said it maybe this week, today even, that, you know, players will adjust to the hip drop tackle. It's just a matter of, like you said, I mean, how liberal is the rule going to be applied? Are they going to allow players to maybe, you know, perform a hip drop tackle and not call the penalty depending on, you know, circumstance, you know, part of the game, during the game, you know, more likely to call it in the first quarter versus the fourth quarter, in a blowout versus a tight game. So, yeah, it does open the door for potential issues. I just think that it was a rule that needed to happen because, you know, guys are getting significantly injured, and it's you know, maybe a feeling out process for 2024. I would hope that if the officials err on any side, they'll err more on allowing players to kind of get away with a hip drop tackle every now and then versus, you know, throwing a flag on, you know, on a key fourth down drive that could potentially, you know, cost the team a win.
It will definitely drive me nuts if they don't call it consistently across the league. Like, you're going to have one crew do one thing, one crew do another thing.
Look, it's not going to be consistent. I can tell you right now. We haven't watched a game yet. You know it's not going to be consistent, especially in the beginning. Especially, like you said, you know, officiating crew to officiating crew. So, yeah, if you're looking for consistency off the jump, I think you're going to be pissed because I don't think that.
I am going to be pissed. Every week I'll be on here bitching.
I mean, if you're looking for consistency in general, the NFL officiating is, like, not where you want to turn your sights to.
I mean, officiating is terrible. I mean, it's funny that you said that because I think the NFL officiating is awful. I think the NBA officiating is awful. I think generally officiating is terrible. I think umpires in baseball suck. You know, I think they all suck. I think I've always felt that way.
Wait, so you're saying that all of the officiating and all of the major sports in America has recently become subpar. What other major change in North American sports can we attribute to this change? Is it the fact that I can bet on anything on my cell phone at any point in time? Huh. We'll tune into the next episode of Breaking the Plane to find out. Manish, dude, I cannot thank you enough for answering my random fucking DM a couple months ago. I can't thank you enough for carving out another hour for us here. I mean, we stayed like 2.5 times as long as like we kind of initially thought here.
Yeah.
So I just want to thank you so much for coming on. You're always so forthcoming with information. You're always so elaborative on every topic. There's nothing. We're never left wanting or wishing when you come on, man. So I really do appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate you guys. It's always a lot of fun. And hopefully we do it again before the draft. I love the draft just because there's so much maneuvering going on behind the scenes. And then when draft day comes or the day before the draft comes, you know, the whispers and the rumors get louder. And it's a great time of year, which is funny because it's nowhere near the start of the actual games. But I appreciate you guys having me on anytime. It's a lot of fun.
So, what are you doing on the night of the draft? You're not busy or anything, right?
On the night of the draft, on Thursday night? I mean, I don't know. I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see. We got a date. We got a date then. That's what I just heard. So we're all set.
we can talk about you guys bitching and complaining about trade downs?
It's fucking 8:50 instead of 8:03 like we were supposed to. It's
annoying, dude. We can talk about J.J. McCarthy being the next Tom Brady. Well, you know.
Yeah, you'll have to cut the noose down from the fucking ceiling so you can talk to me.
But anyway. All right. So this has been the 26th edition of the Breaking the Plane podcast. I'm your host, Joe Scher, with our very special guest, Manish Mehta, with our co-host, Burge, our co-host, Hogan. We miss you, Kojak, out there. I know you're listening. I know you're just chomping at the bit to edit. So we wish to see you soon on the podcast, Co. But other than that, this is Joe signing off for the latest edition of Breaking the Plane. And don't you forget out there. Don't you forget. I'm trying something new. Don't make fun of me. But don't you out there. Don't you forget to break that plane. All right. We'll see you next week, boys.
Later. Peace.